You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk can be supported by listeners like you at patreon.com/monstertalk or by leaving positive reviews on iTunes and other podcasting sites. Learn more at monstertalk.org/support. Thanks to all of you who are supporting us in this way. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or exceed your expectations.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
In this episode, we're talking with Professor Richard Harrison of Mount Royal University in Alberta. Richard teaches extensively about comics, and we really enjoyed talking with him about comic books, their history, their use of monsters, and the way that the art form itself has changed over time. It's gone from being a popular post-war art form, to the target of a huge moral panic, to being dismissed as kid books, to rising back to a respected form of literature, to being the dominant basis of billions of dollars worth of movies and merchandise. And there are monsters in every step of that story. So let's just get straight to the
Monster Talk.
Tonight, we've got a guest, Richard Harrison, who's coming to talk to us about comic book monsters. But before we talk about comic book monsters, we're also going to need to talk a little bit about what is a comic book. But before we talk about what is a comic book, we need to talk about who is Richard Harrison. So I've brought on a special guest to talk about Richard Harrison, who he is. Introducing Richard Harrison.
Well, I've known that guy a long time, I'll tell you. I mean, the thing to know about me in this context most is that I teach comics and graphic novels at Mount Royal University in Calgary. I've been a fan of comics since I was, I think I was seven when I bought my first, six or seven when I got my first comic. Actually my first, I could tell you this story. My first Marvel comic was the introduction of the Green Goblin.
Ooh.
And, I bought it for my brother who was very sick with a fever at the time. So he was, and in those days, like we're talking early '60s, the treatment for fever was I guess aspirin and then cold bath
and comics
that was my contribution to the medical profession. He had to take these cold baths to bring the fever down and then rest a lot. So there was, he was not a happy little guy. So I went and bought him this comic. It wasn't actually the comic that introduced Green Goblin. It was the first Marvel Collector's Item Classics that reprinted that. But it was, in line with what we're talking about, the first encounter between Spider-Man and the Hulk. And beautiful old Steve Ditko comic. Mm. And that was really the thing that kind of hooked me. I said, okay, I really love this stuff. I really love these comics. And I've loved them all my life. And then, but of course, being a child of the 60s, 70s, comics were things that you were supposed to put aside as a, you know, they were the childish things. So I kind of went through an eclipse with comics and then sort of came back to them later in my life and started reading them all over again. And then at one point, dropped a code word, a comic code word, to a colleague of mine in a department meeting. And we knew we had both been lovers of the game, of the genre. And we decided that it was time that we should start teaching comics and graphic novels as literature. First course I taught, comics as literature. We still had to make that case. And we've been teaching it ever since. I've spoken at the San Diego Comic-Con, the comic expos here. I've written several essays, the latest in an anthology by Anna Papard called Super Sex, about essays on sexuality in comic books. And I've been, you know, it's been a tremendously wonderful story to have ended up meeting people like, you know, Chris Claremont and Neil Gaiman, Adam West, all through that kind of study. My brother came down with COVID. It was really rough. And so I sent him Marvel True Believers reprint of that very Green Goblin introductory. Oh,
that's nice.
And he wrote me back and he said, "I feel cold baths and better."
Nice. Well, I want to add too, Richard, that we have Patty Mascaro, who's a friend of the show, to thank for bringing you on. She recommended you to us. So she was a colleague of yours from Mount Royal University.
She is. She's a wonderful friend and godmother to my son. So, I love Patty, and I thank her very much for introducing me to you too.
It seems like you have a dream job. I think in the minds of a lot of our listeners, they would think that you have a dream job, but certainly not everyone reads comics. And I grew up in Australia. And my father would buy comics for me, but usually Archie comics and Betty and Victoria, Veronica rather, and also British comedy stuff. So I'm not sure if you'd be familiar with comic books like Viz and Whizzer and Chips. I think some of those are defunct now, but going back to the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. But just to begin with, if we can get a definition for comics, what are comics and where do they come from?
Well, I mean, we could do the entire podcast on that.
Sure.
Because, I mean, people have been debating this for a long time. If you think of comics if we take comics from the sort of late 1800s as the defining point, then you've got an art form in which both the words and the pictures are essential to the telling of the whole story. Then you've got the 1800s onwards. I think they go, and I mean, Scott McCloud's book, Understanding Comics, you know, he sort of says, okay, that's the that is a worthwhile definition because it at least pinpoints a time. But he goes, and I pretty well anyone who thinks, you know, the scholars on this are always debating because you look at, you know, cave paintings, petroglyphs, hieroglyphs, where there is a pictogram or a picture or a painting that is also a key point in storytelling. And in some sense, you know, I'm going to be cheeky and just go, okay, they started about 17,000 years ago in the Lascaux Caves, where you've got these wonderful, wonderful paintings of animals, people, different kinds of animals, different scenes. And they were used by storytellers as the fixed points or the things to point to while they were telling stories to the other members of the group. And because there was no writing, it was impossible for there to be a comic in the sort of 19th century sense, but there had to be a storyteller. So you've got the Lascaux cave paintings, you've got the petroglyphs, you've got writing on stone out here in Alberta. where the text, what we would call a text, was provided by a human being. But that human being needed the pictures to tell the story, and the stories needed the human being for the story to be told. So on one sense, I mean, to take it to that level, on one sense, it's comics, stories and pictures essential to the telling of a story, story to the essential, that being essential to the unity of the community. Comics invented us.
That's interesting. I'm trying to think of when I first heard this argument, but it would have been when I was probably in high school in the 80s. There was the discussion about the differences between a comic and a graphic novel. And that was around the same time we started to see some of the more ambitious comics works. This is right around the time, I guess The Watchmen was coming out around the time I was a senior, I think. And so it was a transformation from what I think people thought of as sort of, that's just kids stuff. And then like turning it into a form of literature. And obviously that's I'm not really sure. I come from an English major background, but I'm not quite sure exactly what constitutes literature, which these are all, I guess, arbitrary designations in some ways, you know, but like, what do you see as being that sort of difference between a comic and a graphic novel? Is it just the binding is there a meritocracy of content involved here? Like what?
well, on one level, I mean, Will Eisner is largely regarded as the person who coined the term graphic novel. And he was a comic book artist or a comic artist in the 40s, 50s, one of the pioneering figures of the form. His comic was known as, it was called The Spirit. And he was a crime fighter who everyone thought was dead, but wasn't. I mean, that whole returning to from the dead, we will return to that. But it seems to be a very key element to comic literature. But he had this character called the Spirit, and he wanted to. He saw what was going on in North America as a degradation of the comic form, which he loved, and he proved over and over again was extremely valuable. Because he was the one who did the instruction manuals for soldiers in World War II. Remember, the level of literacy was not very high, and so instruction manuals on how to assemble a field rifle, how to, you know, fix a Jeep, how to take care of yourself, proper hygiene. All of that was Eisner's work to turn very boring manuals into accessible writing for people whose literacy levels were varied. Hugely successful. Soldiers who were trained with Eisner's comics were far better at what they did than soldiers who were tried to train through pure text. So Eisner could see the value of the comic, and he could see other cultures valued comics more than they did in North America for various reasons. So he produced what most people regard as the first graphic novel, which is called A Contract with God. And it's actually four interlinked stories that are told around an apartment, tenement apartment in the lower east side of Manhattan on what's called Dropsy Avenue. And they are stories of the tenement dwellers, the immigrants to New York. And they were in fact centered around the life of Jewish immigrants in New York. And Contract with God was Eisner's way of actually coping with the death of his own daughter, his young daughter, by challenging the whole concept of what we owe God and God owes us. It's a fabulous, fabulous piece of work. And he wanted to get it into adult hands. So he knew that bigger comic wasn't going to do any better than thin comics, you know, would do to get it into Barnes and Noble. So he coined the phrase graphic novel as a pitch to say, it's not a comic, it's a graphic novel. And they gave it a chance. It opened up the door for adults to start reading comics again. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. And it effectively, what I think is that comics are sequential. That is, if you pick up an issue of Superman, you know there's going to be another 25, 30, 40, or apparently I think there's 1,000 issues of Superman. Superman's story never ends. Whereas a graphic novel is bound by time and space the way that we and other novels are bound by time and space, where there's a beginning and an end. So there's a lot of things that you can do in a graphic novel that you really can't do in a property like Spider-Man, Wonder Woman, etc., because they rely on continuous publication. Right? They never actually have a beginning or an end. They just exist in a contemporaneous present all the time. Charlie Brown never ages. Right? Superman never ages. Whereas in a graphic novel, you'll see someone go through the transformation that a character does in a text novel.
So that's, that's sort of like a myth space, right? I mean, like, there's not so much in our mythic stories about these, you know, heroes. Zeus is getting old, you know, I'm getting too old for this crap. You know, like that's not, there's an ever present, like that seems to be like the home of a lot of these kind of mythic type characters. And I think that falls in there, I guess, right?
Yeah, they never actually, none of these characters age. They just either are like Zeus, no longer believed in, or, you know, like, you know, so many comic book characters from the 50s onwards, they just get canceled.
a quick follow-up. I haven't really thought about this much until just now, which is probably me just being short-sighted, but when I think about the history of comics, a lot of it, comes out of New York and largely influenced by a lot of important creators were Jewish in their culture, if not religion. And I'm thinking here about Superman and a lot of the early artists that were, you know, doing some of the influential stuff that I really liked. But and Spiegelman for Mouse, but that's not old, but that's the 80s. But Eisner. I mean, but so obviously not everyone in comics at the time came from that background. But it's like, if I remember correctly, a lot of this came out of like people working out of like the Fabric District or something. Like that New York Jewish influence seems really powerful. But obviously, that's American comics. America's not the only place where these were being created. Are there other places, other cultural influences that are as powerful, or am I reading that correctly, that is really a really strong influence there?
No, it is a very strong influence. And if you look at, I mean, the New York Lower East Side, there were 250,000 people living there in these tenements. And you know, a lot of them were Jewish emigres from persecution in Europe. They weren't solely Jewish, of course, but there were a lot of them. A lot of that was high proportion, very concentrated. And what you get is Broadway, comic books, and there's a huge influence, of course, those who went out to the West Coast in Hollywood, because the Jewish identity, you know, is largely formed around storytelling, right? Held together by stories. The people of the book is a name they give themselves. And so what is happening there is it's diasporic. A lot of it is diasporic literature. It's about people being emigres and trying to fit into a new planet. Like Superman is, his Jerusalem is Krypton. It's destroyed. It's gone, right? Remember, at this time, we're talking about the 1930s. And a lot of the Jewish homelands, a lot of places they live, are gone or denied them. And they're trying to live in this new place, trying to find preserve an identity that's continuous with the past, and yet forge an identity that's congruent and can live within the future. And it's, you know, all of these things are about people gathering together and telling stories, singing songs. It's all it, at least in terms of Broadway or shows, it's all derived from the way in which they preserve their community through story. And, you know, there, it's not exclusive to Jewish emigres in New York, but it is certainly an element of what's going on there. And I mean, we, if we were doing a podcast on Superman, for example, I would go down all the list of his characteristics of what it meant to be who you were and who you had to be, who you were to be continuous with the past, Superman's Kal-El, and who you need to be congruent, to fit within the future, fit within the present. So he's Clark Kent. And how to fit in with that new world, consistent with the principles of your homeland that no longer exists. There's a lot of really lovely layering going on in the in these stories, and they are very they're cheap to make, you know, you're dealing with people who don't have a lot of resources, but they do have a desire to read and tell each other things and make stuff up that, you know, navigates the world. So
fascinating.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm gonna say, I mean, Japanese comics come from a very different set of origin. I mean, we could do another, we could do a world tour to talk about different, you know, why there's different sensibilities in comics. And now that comics have become far more cosmopolitan, you can see these different influences coming in and shaping the sort of continuous production of the comic now.
So I think we should move on to talk about comic book monsters as the topic that we wanted to treat in this episode. And I know that we're talking about so many different kinds of comics within that, that genre, but who are the monsters in comic books? What is a monster according to comic books? Are we talking about supervillains, or are we talking about cryptids?
I think to see how monsters appear in, and again, if I can just confine it for a sec to the sort of North American comic, that the comic monsters begin to appear in comic books after they appear in movies.
Okay.
So either, well, sort of two sources, movies and text literature. So you've got two sort of main sources for the first appearances of monster comics in North America in the sort of 40s, right? Late 30s, early 40s. And so you've got the literary monsters like Dracula and Frankenstein, Frankenstein's monster. And then you've got the folktale monsters who you made it into movies through, like Wolfman, and then a version of Dracula, the Mummy, which becomes really, really impressive and important when they're discovering, you know, uncovering, you know, they're sort of rediscovering Egypt. Things like, you know, the Creature, Godzilla, King Kong, that migrate from the cinema into comics. And the comics owed a lot of their early popularity to the movies as a source, as source material. In fact, the comic book is a sort of like the third, is the, you know, it's the child of the syndicated comic in the newspapers. And that's where even Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster wanted to get their first Superman story, was into the newspapers. They didn't even know what a comic book was. That comes later. But the movies were the big fuel for monster comics. And then once those start to show up, then you get monsters appearing in not just their own comics, but in the burgeoning superhero stuff from the late 30s onwards, where the monster becomes what the superhero has to fight.
Right.
Dick Tracy's, you know, villains are, a lot of them borderline on monsters, like they at least visually. They, mm-hmm. And I always thought that was intriguing, because I didn't know exactly, like, I didn't know why. Like, it never made, like, it was weird to me. Because, I mean, in a superhero comic, it makes perfect sense that, well, there's superheroes, there's going to be supervillains. Otherwise, it's just going to be very one-sided. I mean, if you've ever watched the old TV Superman, with just a few exceptions, he's largely just fighting gangsters. And it's really kind of, like, it's just... even as Superman, it's a little too easy, right?
Yeah.
So, but they have, like, you know, there are a lot of genres within comics. You know, there's Western comics and horror comics and, you know, like, sort of noir crime comics and romance comics. And obviously you could go on much further than I could with that. But do you get a feel for, did the monsters mostly show up in horror comics first, or did they show up all over the place, or like where do they first begin in your estimation? I mean, and we're putting you on the spot here, 'cause I know we're talking in sort of broad terms, and I guess specifically, I'm not asking you to, like, I need you to be declaring this so I can get it on Wikipedia. I just, roughly.
I'd be revised and edited within 24 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the monsters, I guess we come back. I mean, you're right. There are some really ugly, distorted characters, you know, Dick Tracy, Prune Face and Flat Top and those characters. Certainly the Joker in Batman, these are distorted or disfigured human beings or just ugly human beings, because the comics is a visual language, right? So you've got to have something to say, this character is different from this character. And the invention of costumes was a big favor, right? You don't really have to care about what they look like. They just are all in red or have a big cape. but I keep coming back to, you know, what a monster is dependent on what it represents. And, you know, if you go back to, again, I'm going to go slip back to the mythology, right? Where indeed there's some monsters like the Hydra, the Nemean lion, the Griffins, you know, the Gorgons. These were monsters in Greek mythology. The Golem, who was either a monster or a savior, depending on which story you read in the Jewish mythology, etc. They take from everywhere. Those monsters, Golem is different, but say Hydra, the Hydra out of the swamps of Lernia is the creature from the Black Lagoon. Right? It's another sort of force of nature in animal form, against which the hero is pitted to, you know, ensure their own survival or the survival of an innocent person. Effectively, it's animal nature versus humans. And I see those monsters as representative of the forces that would consume us. Because we were really afraid of, you know, mastodons and snakes and stuff. They were the overpowering. They were the force with which we had to contend, or they were representatives of natural forces with which we had to contend, right? There was a time when animals were our, like, worst enemy, right? Those monsters have that represent that. So they're largely just pure forces. I think that changes with Frankenstein, where Mary Shelley creates a creature whom everyone else sees as a monster, but who is actually very refined, very educated, very sensitive, only wants to be loved, but is turned into a vicious creature by our own reaction to his ugliness, his otherness. So the monster goes from being this a creature that has no relationship to us, is indifferent to us, we're just prey, right? Or an annoyance, to something that wanted to belong with us but was outcast. And from then on, the true monsters, and I think the Hulk is like that kind of a character. the Thing from the Fantastic Four, even, Venom or Blockbuster or Killer Croc, or you just keep rolling them out.
Please excuse this brief editorial interruption. At this point in the conversation, we got into a discussion about the etymology of the word monster, which I'm editing here for clarity. There seems to be a general consensus that the word monster comes from the Latin word monstrum, which has its roots in the idea of a warning. Monsters, often literally monstrous births, were considered to be omens or warnings. But many other words with similar roots have been tied to the word monster through both literal etymology, such as the word demonstrate, and also through folk etymology. And our conversation included a discussion of the word monarchy, which comes from the roots mono, meaning one, and archon, meaning leader. And this provides deep poetic connections with the power of monsters as well as their innate loneliness. And with that clarification, we return you to this conversation, already in progress.
The monster is always the only one of its kind, constantly looking for another of its kind. And in the end sort of turns to us and we reject it. That the psychological monster, the social monster.
Wait, are you saying that the Frankenstein monster was the first incel? Is that...
He was looking for a bride. He got one. He almost got one.
He got close.
Right. Want to be loved.
He did, though, right?
He did. He wanted a companionship. He wanted to be human. Or he wanted the companionship of like minds. And he was in some ways smarter and kinder until pushed, and then things, yeah. And I think everybody, if you compare that to, say, Eric, the villain from the Phantom of the Opera, who is hideous, but is also internally a monster. There's not much sympathy for Eric. He's a really bad character.
Yeah, he is. He's like the predecessor for characters like Two-Face and the Joker, who's driven mad by his own disfigurement. But he knows that no one's going to accept him. Like he sort of preemptorily just realizes what he is. That's interesting, because he's surrounded by the best music in the world, Eric is.
Yeah.
And yet it has no effect on him.
Well, he seems fond of Christine. I mean,
right? Yeah, he longs for someone. He's driven, but again, they're all driven by their aloneness, right? Like they're all driven.
Oh, and I bet that never rang true for any comic book kid reading alone at home. I'm having flashbacks is what I'm saying.
No wonder we all love them.
That's it's our show is monsters, and we use them as a springboard to talk about science and culture and all kinds of things. But ultimately, I think you're right. One of the reasons we often love monsters when they're not, even things like Godzilla, which is maybe he's a force of nature, I don't know, but like it's easy to feel sympathy across those stories because we see the humanity even in the monstrous, and loneliness is such a visceral, emotion is so powerful to have, that yearning for companionship and an equal mind and all that sort of thing. And sometimes
to relate to that.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. will speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about. The stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
And I think, too, that the other element there is that with a character like Godzilla, or, you know, the Hulk, monster still does. It's not like we're completely unjustified in our reaction to the monster, because, you know, these monsters are created for us. They're all fictional characters, but they're all created for us to embody something we are terrified of. And in the case of Godzilla, it's nuclear war. Because he's created by the atom bomb, right? And then he becomes the destruction of the atom bomb, personified as a lizard, right? And the Hulk is created by an atomic explosion, and rage, and a human rage that's unleashed because of the power of the atom. So you do get to see, I don't think you ever completely lose the fact that these are forces of nature given some sort of animal or human form.
So it seems over the past couple of decades that comics have become recognized as a form of literature more and more. And how has the role of monsters in that medium changed over time?
Well, I think there's a great deal more sympathy for the monstrous figure in certainly in comics. You know, in the comics code, in the late 50s, right, they said you can't have any sympathy for the villain. Like, it's actually in code. they broke that pretty quickly. I think the first character who broke that in Marvel, anyway, in this, that was from 1960, when they reintroduced the superhero, when Marvel did, DC did a few years earlier, was the Mole Man, he looked like a mole. Like, he was just a mole-ish kind of person, and the you know, very, very nearsighted, the whole bit. And he lives in the underneath the earth because he can't stand the reaction that he gets to human being, or the ordinary people give him, sort of like the penguin, right? The penguin with the but we were given a story with which we had sympathy. Because we all know what it feels like to be ridiculed for something that's not our fault. And more, you know, I see these characters, you know, who are either true monsters in the sense that they are, they're distorted shapes, like Venom, who's got like three movies now, or The Thing. They're even letting Martian Manhunter be more monstrous in appearance, right? They're letting him be more Martian, again, et cetera. But they're more figures of sympathy than they were figures of fear. And I mean, now they're more they're heroes, right? So they've gone from being that which the hero must destroy in order to be the hero, to, you know, the hero itself, himself, herself, who has to actually has to show us how to live with their own aloneness.
Every time I think about The Thing, I think about the there's an indie comic called Concrete. And it's so interesting because it could be a superhero comic, but it's largely just a guy who's suddenly stuck into a body of stone and having like trying to live a normal life. And it's just it's so heart touching in some ways. But you know, that's true for The Thing as well. The Ben Graham character. He's super tough. He's super strong, but can he feel it when you touch him? So he's got this, he's kind of blocked off from the world of the senses in some ways, you know? And so, and he also sees himself as hideous. So he ends up dating a blind girl, which sort of resolves some of the, anyway, we don't need to revisit his complicated story. Anyway, but I think about this all the time about, you just barely mentioned it, but this comics code and the way comics have been viewed over time. For example, I'm a big fan of EC Comics, and I'm actually rereading very slowly because I have too many things on my to-do list. But I'm reading my way through Tales from the Crypt. And there's not actually that many issues of them, but and those largely came out of there. A lot of that material is just repurposed stuff that's in the public domain and stuff that's not technically in the public domain. So they, scratch the serial numbers off.
They did a lot of that.
It caused a lot of outrage. But that outrage never, even though the comics code stuff happened, and I'd like you to talk about that a little bit, but I remember one of my first comics that I bought, it was related to a doctor's visit. The doctor's office was right next to a little drugstore. And I went from the doctor's office over to the drugstore with a couple of bucks that I had. And I bought a Spider-Man comic book and a UFO comic book. And I was very excited about both. The UFO one was the Gold Key series. Those were amazing.
I love those, yeah.
And the comic book was Spider-Man Meets Ghost Rider. And oh my gosh, my mom caught glimpse of Ghost Rider and his Hellfire, and wow, that comic book did not make it. So I don't know how that
did
turned
you get
out.
To read it at
no,
all?
No, no, no. I got to watch my dollar go in the trash can. So, So anyway, but the point is, people have a lot of moral judgments about comics. I imagine the monsters don't help that. Can you talk a little bit about how the sort of moral panic around comic books happened and what that led to code-wise?
For sure. That is known as the Dark Ages, among comic people who like to, mark eras. Effectively, after the end of this, prior to Second World War time, you've got Captain America, Superman, Batman, Justice Society. You've got a burgeoning of comics. But you've also got true crime comics, creepy tales, weird tales. Like all of these comics are being produced. Comics are being produced by the thousands, because after you get the success of Superman, suddenly comics go from being small business to big business. And it's known as the Golden Age because the artists and the writers could do whatever they wanted. Like whatever you can imagine, draw that. So you've got this wide range of comics, extraordinarily wide variety in terms of quality. But there's really no moral. There's almost no morality, right? There's just everybody just told the stories they wanted to tell, which is the way in which literature kind of works, right? At its maximum level of freedom, you can tell the story you want to tell. And so they did that. But after the war is over, two things happened. One is after the war is over, and I may have conflated this a bit here. After the war is over, a lot of comics faded away just because people weren't interested in them anymore. But partly, and I've heard this, I've read this. I'm not sure how deeply sort of. I'm not sure how to think about it yet. But let's put it this way: that the comics, because they're instantaneous, like they come out every month, or every week, or two weeks, they are responding very, very quickly to what the audience wants, and what the audience will reject. You get comic companies just springing up, going for 4 weeks and disappearing. And some people argue that comics became more grotesque, more criminal. The crimes became more exaggerated. The bloodshed was more pronounced because a lot of people came back. A lot of the comic readers, i.e. American servicemen, because they'd been trained to read comics, because they were trained as soldiers through comics. They came back and they wanted from their entertainment something that would connect with their experience. And, you know, people coming back from war, you know, bloodshed isn't I can't look at this. There is this sense that the world is a lot tougher. So comic books got tougher. Now, because comic books are, this is what David Lloyd, the guy who drew V for Vendetta, he told me when I was at a Comic-Con, he said, the reason comic books are disparaged is because children can make them. Anyone with a pencil can make a comic. And, you know, I would add, because children can read them. Children can read much more sophisticated stories in comic book form than they can in text form. So they can be very, very influential at an early age. So when you get these comics that are drawn by adults and they are accessible to children, then you've got all the makings of the moral panic. And what was happening in the 50s in America was a lot. It was causing a lot. There was a huge social disruption. And so Red Book, the magazine, started to produce a series of articles by Frederick Wortham, the psychologist, about the dangers of comic books as affecting children. And Wortham played very fast and loose with his clinical experience. This is very clear. But he would argue that the delinquents, to use that term, the delinquents that he was working with and that he was studying to figure out what was going on, they all read comics. So comics were a contributor to delinquency. So he reread comics as promoting violence, promoting drug use, promoting crime, promoting homosexuality, promoting communism, promoting all the things that America was terrified of. So there was right alongside the same inquiry into Hollywood films, they were busy looking at comic books. And in order to save themselves, those comics that couldn't save themselves, like the EC line, there were no more creepy horror comics, no more people, you know, the dead eating the living, all that stuff, none of that. They either got right out of the comic book business. Max Gaines got out and formed Mad Magazine, because magazines were different than comic books. Some of them just shut up, they closed house. Lots of people were fired. Lots of people went into advertising, other things that they could use their talents for. And the narrowly defined topics of comics were what kept comics alive. The three or four top ones were romance comics. They invented the romance comic in order to save themselves, to keep publishing. The Western, space comics, sanitized space comics, of course, and monster comics. Because monsters, if you look at the way the monsters went in comics during that period the comics business looked at what was happening in the movie business. And the movie business ended up being governed by what was known as the Hays Code. Hayes. And Hayes Code says, you can't show this, you can't show that, you can't show this. So movies became very confined. Comics went, you don't have to give us a Hayes Code, we'll do it ourselves. So they invented the Comics Code. And so all the comics had to pass this code, which said things like evil can't win, no sympathy for the devil. Characters couldn't be too ugly to designate themselves as villains or heroes. No sex, of course, no drug use. You know, it's no grotesqueries, no mutilation, no showing of any sexualized parts of the human body, all that stuff. So monsters showed up as part of the lifeline of comics. And you look at the comic, you look at the monsters during this period. So we're looking at the sort of 50s, 1950s. They're very cute. One of them was Groot, the living tree, right? But you get Groot, Goom, Fin Fang Foom. You get these wordplay, horrific, but not really horrific kind of monsters, who are playing out these fantasy stories because they were kind of, they passed the code, they were safe. So on one level, the comedic possibility of the monster, and you see that in characters like Big Hero 6, the Pixar character, like that big balloon, looks like the Pillsbury Doughboy.
Yeah, my son loves that, yeah.
Yeah, it's fun as all.
Baymax, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's his name. Or even the Pillsbury Doughboy in Ghostbusters, right? You get these cute and cuddly kind of monsters, where they become sort of, because they're so different from human beings, they become the vehicles for those stories to be told, with their moral lessons and their requisite suspense, but not horror, that pass the code.
It's the call of cute Cthulhu.
That's good. Yeah.
So I've never heard of romance comics. And so if you had the code with no sex, were these just kind of PG-13?
Oh yeah,
yeah. There's no sex. It's marriage.
Yeah, it's all teenage longing. I want to be. Oh, it's there. And they were huge. Like when this is part of the comics history that becomes really interesting for people who want to study gender in comics, is that effectively the comics corporations realized that they couldn't sell to their old cohort. So they had to expand who they were selling to. So instead of just boys, they started to sell to girls.
Right. And it's like Biddy and Veronica then with the Archie comics that my dad would get me.
That's right. They were that's right. And yeah. There was a lot of sexual tension. It was all sexual tension of the sort of grade 11 level, right? nobody actually did anything, or if they did anything, it was completely offstage or implied. but they would sell, young romance would sell 500,000 comics a month. They had a huge audience. But once the code started to loosen and DC started to reintroduce the characters who had been sort of effectively sidelined by poor sales or the code or both, they downplayed those comics. They started to disappear again. There are two other things here to say. One is that the Funny Animal comic starts to really take off during this period. Disney, Looney Tunes, they all were reintroducing these characters, and they were not monsters. Tasmanian Devil, maybe, but they weren't monsters in that sense, but they were non-human representations of human characteristics. And they were very acceptable. Everyone loves Donald Duck and Scrooge McDuck and all those characters. So that was a big market for comics during this period. And in a kind of way, monsters were, they had that sort of alliance with the cartoon characters more than they did with their old movie predecessors.
Could you talk a little bit about this transition from this period where we had the 10-cent menace and this, this comics code scare and the moral panic to the world we are in now, where basically the Marvel Cinematic Universe rules the box office and like everything's a comic book movie? Like that's an incredible transition in what seems like a pretty short amount of time. I say it's a short amount of time. It's my lifetime is what it is.
Very short.
When you think about, right, where Stan Lee is writing Spider-Man and Fantastic Four in 19, you know, sort of 1960 to in the early 60s, and he won't even tell people what his job is. He was the sort of cameo king of Hollywood. It is stunning. It is really stunning. I mean, I know a lot of old comic book fans like me who resent all of it, right? They never understood, because once comics became very popular, then what was important about being a comic reader started to diminish, because you were this exclusive group of people who were getting something that no one else got. And now everyone gets it. So,
that we have the same feeling in the IT world for people who still know how to pop open a terminal and type, you know, commands. It's like, oh, you graphics people with your fancy interfaces, you know. There is that sort of, I've got a special knowledge, and now it's become popular, and you know, they're not real fans, and that happens all the time. Mm-hmm. There's an elitism or something there. Yeah.
Well, there is something about, you know, and again, I mean, it's back to monsters. You know, monsters do cling to their identity, right? They you know, I don't know if you saw the latest Spider-Man picture, right? Where Peter Parker decides that the way to save Dr. Octopus and the Lizard and the Sandman, they're kind of monstrous characters, right? The Lizard is the creature.
Spoiler warning, I suspect. Spoiler warning.
Oh, all right. I'm not going to say another.
I mean, one. Although it's made so much money, you might assume everyone's already seen it twice, because, good Lord, that movie has done well.
It's done very well.
Finish your thought.
It effectively says, and there's nothing wrong. I won't say how it all ends or anything, but effectively, instead of fighting them, Peter Parker decides to cure them, right? So, because they're all driven, like Dr. Octopus is in the movies, he's driven mad by the accident that fuses his body with these artificial limbs. Again, another primal fear, right? The loss of integrity of the body and being taken over by technology. The Lizard is a human being transformed into this Lizard, right? In both the comics and I think in the movie, I'm pretty sure, is because he's lost his arm and he's trying to find a way to regenerate his own arm, his own human arm, by using Lizard DNA. And of course, this is a huge fear we all have, that our DNA will be corrupted and we'll turn into monsters. Sandman is a human being who's turned into this pile of animated sand. In the comics, it was originally by an atomic accident. I don't remember why it happened in the movies.
In the Raimi movie, I'm pretty sure he was in a nuclear accident as well. It was one of those things.
Spider-Man, the Spectacular Spider-Man comic book series, it was the result of an attempt to make an invulnerable human being. But they're all monsters, right? And so he decides he's going to cure them, and they resist. Right? They don't want to be cured. And so they have this debate, which we all have, right? In terms of our individuality, ultimately, in terms of our individuality, we all have to decide whether what makes us who we are is a gift or a curse. Mm-hmm. And that gets debated in that particular film. And I think that's part of where monsters are going, is that, you know, are they in fact, you know, figures we should fear, or are they models for how we should actually be about our own individuality?
Oh, this is the same debate I have about puns all the time. You know, is it a power? Is it a curse? Yeah. It's
So anyway, the other question you asked me, how did the Marvel Cinematic Universe rule the world now? I mean, partly, you know, the sort of easiest answer to make is now the movie audiences are people like us who've been raised reading comics. And at last, you know, we can see our heroes on screen, you know, up with the other fantasy figures that movies and you know, figures whose stories provide a spectacle. Right, which is what movies have become more than anything. Like, it is about the spectacle. Go to the movies and be filled with awe and wonder. Those storylines are completely designed for that to happen. So partly it's, you know, the movie's changed because the audience does. But I think there's something more about it. I think there's something, or at least something extra you can say, right? Because, you know, comic books have been making it into other elements of popular culture almost since the beginning. Like the Fleischer Superman pictures, they appear 2 years after Superman hits the stands. The Batman television series arrives in 1966. Actually, right about the time that the Batman comics are starting to fade away because they're so code suppressed that the Dark Knight of Gotham has become a clown, right? And even his fans don't want to see him anymore. The television show is what revives that character. The Tim Burton Batman and the early X-Men pictures, 1989, 1990s, you know, they are starting to, they've been doing that now. 1990 is 30 years ago. So this has been happening in movies. The serial, like the Fleischer comics cartoons, were shown before the major motion pictures. Radio took these characters on like mad. You know, here's a bit of trivia. Batman and Superman first meet on radio.
Wow.
Interesting.
There you go.
Were they friends?
they were friends. They were friends on radio. Kryptonite first appears on radio. Superman flies first in the cartoons. So these characters have been going back and forth between their print form and their other media forms almost since the beginning.
Yeah, that's okay. That's fascinating too, because I see that kind of looping cultural interchange a lot around monsters in folklore, monsters as people actually report seeing them, and monsters in movies. And I've come to think about it as like this loop of inner, you know, elements being passed back and forth, you know, the stories people see provide a cultural template for the things that they can experience, which in turn informs the fiction and the folklore and the kinds of experiences people have. And I started calling it a perpetual notion machine, because it's just this constant loop and interchange. And it seems to be, we're driven by stories. We live our lives in stories. We have, we biographize in story. Like that's how we experience the world, is through stories. And so, that makes perfect sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm gonna quote you on the perpetual notion machine.
Oh, you should. Yeah.
Well, I will. But so now, okay, I'm gonna get my own hobby horse here, right? Because I have my own theory. This is one of those things that you get to do every so often.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that What those of us who love comics never really felt, you know, during our own childhoods, or like you say, your mom who throws away, you know, Ghost Rider meets Spider-Man, was we felt disdain for a form of art we loved. And when it started to be treated with some respect in the shows that we all mention, like I just did, about, you know, these characters. There was plenty of shows that were made that have no respect for the characters at all. But when we started to see the respect for the characters, or respect for their possibility, we were really happy to see that. But what we really wanted to see, what I think we really wanted to blend, was our awe of things that were already in the movies, right? Space movies and westerns and stuff, big broad vistas of space and time. We wanted to see our awe that we saw in those forms with the awe we felt for the characters that we were reading in comic books. And comic book characters are all small, right? The comic book is something a child can hold in their hands. So, but in our imagination, they're huge. So they're safe because they're tiny, but they're awesome, right? Because they hold this imaginative field for us. And we go to the movies to feel about those characters and their stories the way we felt as children. Only this time, they really are bigger than us.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, things like the technology advancing to the point that we can actually see a Jack Kirby scene brought to life and it looks decent. Like, does it
looks
look
good?
Yeah, yeah. That is I'm so excited about the new Doctor Strange movie. Oh my God. Anyway.
I'll see you there.
The comic movies are popular, but I know that the industry's had to struggle some with this conversion of everybody reading things digitally. Do you have a sense of two things, I guess? One is, how is the comics business doing today? And where do you think the role of monsters in the industry is heading?
Okay. The comic stores are still there. They're not as many as there used to be. The comics are still being produced. Not as many as they used to be. But that's because partly it's digital, so you don't have to buy any of that stuff. But the answer to how the business is doing, effectively, I mean, as much as the comics, as comic companies, DC and Marvel and Image and, et cetera, have to, make a profit or make themselves at least survive, they don't have to do as much as they did anymore, right? DC is owned by Time Warner. Marvel is owned by Disney. And effectively, if you look at the budget, the budget breakdowns for the corporations for which own all these things, Marvel and DC particularly, I'm not sure of all the other relationships there, but Marvel and DC are research and development. Like they are budget lines in their parent companies, like any department. So they only have to make characters who are popular enough for the main company to say, that's interesting, I might make a movie out of that one. So they don't have to be self-supporting anymore. They have to be self-supporting in the way in which the department of, the appliance department in Walmart has to show that it's selling enough appliances to warrant Walmart to keep putting appliances in there, or the Boots. Let's put it this way. Do they sell appliances at Walmart? I don't know. The boot section.
They do. Right? They do. But yeah.
Oh. I figure they sell everything. I can't really go wrong. But you know what I mean? Like, your department is slacking a bit, so, shape up. But it's not the same. I mean, effectively, even the best-selling comics now, they are running at figures that would have caused the issues to be canceled in, 20, 30 years ago.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. But they don't. They don't have to. They just have to. They're testing grounds for the movie property.
Well, I guess there's the indie scene too. I mean, I've got a lot of friends who make their own comics and seem to be, they do well enough that they can keep doing it. I don't think any of them are retiring or getting movie deals, but they're getting their stories out, which is what writers like to do.
Sure. Yeah, and there's a huge and lovely movement. Here in Calgary, we have what's known as Panel One, which is the organization that has a conference every year to bring all these indie comics, creators together. And yeah, they fill, a grade school gym with booths and displays and that sort of thing. That's still a lot of people who are just dedicated to what they do. And of course, you're not allowed to bring any of the commercial properties into the room. it's all just the indie stuff, and with the way in which printing is available now and all that technology of distribution is there, you get some really, really great things going on. So there is that, that will always keep the comic business alive and refreshed, and maybe none of them ever sell, big stuff anywhere else, but it doesn't matter. It's they do it. They really love this form.
Oh, and the latter half of that question was any feel for where monster comics or monsters in comics are heading? I mean, that's a tough question. If you don't have an answer, it's okay. So,
you know, I see the monster, you know, more and more being a kind of figure with which we can feel a great deal more sympathy. There's a sort of cathartic quality to monsters like Venom and like him, you know, who just does what we want to do, right? There's that kind of psychological play with them. Or there is that.
You mean the character who's basically all ego, all id.
Yeah. Like, right. And then Carnage, all psychosis.
Yeah.
I see them, like I said, if not the hero, at least much more the protagonist. I mean, there will always be the monster who's opposed to whatever hero it is. But oftentimes that kind of monster is opposed to another kind of monster, right? Mm-hmm. Who's the good monster. That's where I have no predictive power, but I think that's where I think they're going, is they're going to be, when Spiegelman, made Mouse, in some ways he talks about why he chose to do what he did, and then others, there's lots of scholarship about it. But he took the funny animal comic, he took the Mickey Mouse, and turned it to a figure of sympathy, of huge sympathy, right? All the Jews were all the mice, and put them through the Holocaust. But the reason that worked, like, I don't know how many people would read a Holocaust memoir where there are realistic drawings of people being burned alive or being shot or whatever, all the things that were done. But you are allowed, your guard goes down when you're looking at something that's not you, but is enough like some part of you that you can allow yourself to feel more fully for it than you could for something that was directly you. And I think that's where monsters are going to go. They are going to be locations of feeling, only not like before, not just fear, but sympathy, doubt. We're more patient when a monster has to have a soliloquy than we are when we, each other does.
Right. That's a very difficult thing to predict, but I think that's a pretty good prediction.
Thank you.
So, Richard, we've got one final question for you. We've really enjoyed chatting with you. We could talk for a lot longer about this.
Oh, yeah.
Topic.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Oh.
I think we'll have to have you back on to talk again.
But, thank you. I would love to. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. But we just have one final question for you now, and that's our signature question that we like to ask all of our guests. What's your favorite monster?
When you said that at the beginning of this talk, I was going to say the creature from the Black Lagoon, because he hit my consciousness right at the right time. Mm. Right. So there's that moment, when you go, this is my favorite hockey team because I love that one moment. Right. And I really do like that creature. I just like the look. But now that we've talked at length about this, I think I'm going to go back to Frankenstein's monster. Because I think he, for monsters, is what Superman is to superheroes. The more I look at him, the more I see every aspect of all the other monsters that I think are important or move me. I can revisit this character. I like looking at the creature, but I don't really think about him very much. But I really think a lot about Mary Shelley's creation. So yeah, I'm going to go with Frankenstein's monster.
I love it.
Good answer.
Yeah. And, I've seen lots of illustrations, but Bernie Wrightson's illustrations of that book are so awesome. I don't oh my gosh. Yeah, they're just so good. Anyway, gone too soon.
Made Blake very happy.
Yeah. No, for sure. Yeah. And I mean, I'm a big fan of the Creature from the Black Lagoon too. And we just lost Julie Adams in 2019, who played that just the gorgeous lead in that the female lead in just such an amazing piece of cinema. The costume is just so, it holds up so well. It really does.
It does. It really does.
Yeah. It's not a super complicated film, you know, but it's a hoot. Yeah. It's really fun. So
doesn't have to be.
Yeah, these are all great. I love it. Thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us and our audience. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, it was really interesting.
You're very, very welcome. And Blake, Karen, I've enjoyed this so much. Thank you.
Us too.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with Professor Richard Harrison of Mount Royal University in Alberta discussing the intersection of comic books and monsters. Check out our show notes for lots of links to material that we discussed in our conversation. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones. And we love Kindle, so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as Therapist Uncensored, Subtext, and Small Things Often. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you again for listening and for being a part of the Monster Talk family.
Been a Monster House presentation.